Okay, welcome to the nth iteration of the Cognitive Science 200, the Temporal Dynamics of Learning. Today we're having yet another co-PI on the grant, Javier Mevelin from the Machine Perception Lab at UCSD and the Institute for Neural Computation. Javier's been in the forefront of social robotics for many years, having developed the only, or the best, I should say, real-time expression recognizer, and a robot that actually interacts with 2-year-olds or 18-month-olds, as well as done work with robots developed in Japan. So he's going to tell you about that today. Take it away, Javier.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you about the Ruby project that has been running at the Early Childhood Education Center for the past 3 years. So first, just tell you that I'm part of the Machine Perception Laboratory that is being directed by Marnie Bartlett and Gwen Ford and I. And we've been focusing for the past 15 years, actually, on developing machine perception primitives for social interaction, things like lip reading, face detection, expression recognition. And so, you know, years ago, it was more of a proof of concept type of thing. And as time went by, things started to get better and better. And at some point, it became clear that sometime in the near future, we were going to have systems that could operate reliably in real time in daily life. This is a demo of a system that we put together in 2002. This is Josh Saskin, who is now a grad student in Toronto. And the system was just recognizing some simple expressions and mimicking those expressions. Now, the system was not that good at the time. It was good as long as you gave us the right conditions. But already made the point that okay, this seems very powerful. There were some very interesting things, like the fact that if we had a delay between the person and the agent, which at the first time we had a delay because of a bug, the interaction seemed very nice, like the agent was kind of intentionally reacting. When we got rid of that bug and then the mirroring was instantaneous, then all of a sudden the magic disappeared. So that kind of made us aware of these things that had to do with time. And also made us aware of the fact that, well, you know, suppose that now we have a very good system a few years from now, then what do we do with it? How do we go beyond mimicking facial expressions and this cool expression, right? So we have this very important scientific problem, which is how to integrate perception and action in real time so that we can actually survive, have systems that survive in daily life and that actually help people and interact with people in a social manner. So we decided to focus on interaction with toddlers to help understand simpler and deeper forms of social interaction. In particular, we wanted to avoid language and speech recognition because we felt is a huge can of worms. And also speech recognition doesn't work very well. So we didn't want to rely on that. Also, we felt that if we rely, all the robot teams that I knew about, when they start relying on speech, when speech recognition doesn't work very well, they tend to kind of constrain the situation so that it starts working better. And it moves the research in directions that I didn't want it to move. I rather had a system that operated, even if it's very simple, that operated in real life. I was thinking more of a 3-month-old, pets, this type of thing. Social interactions, but they are simple and not particularly grounded on language. OK, so philosophy of the project. Progressively, we felt that there was the need for a shift in scientific priorities, particularly timing, affects, and the whole problem of how to kind of what I call the operating system of behavior, how the different parts of an organism are put together in real time so that you generate intelligent behavior. Shifting methods, and the idea that, you know, if you want to move outside of the laboratory, and we felt it was very important, then there are all these issues. Well, we are outside the laboratory, we no longer have control. What are going to be efficient methods to work in daily life conditions? And you know, there were no methods at the time, and we had to actually develop them ourselves. And again, this kind of more of a kind of a scientific stand that if we want to understand how the brain works, it's very important to understand the problems that the brain needs to solve and faces when operating in daily life. Okay, so risk management. It was very clear that this was a very risky step for my career. First of all, I asked the question, is this science? Right here, all of a sudden, we move into ECEC, we bring robots with children. We don't really know what our hypothesis. People will ask me, what's your hypothesis? And I don't know, I don't have a hypothesis, other than this is very important. There were not established methods. It was unclear whether we were going to be able to show tangible results. And now you will also see, maybe we don't have tangible results, but we have lots of intangibles that are helping other, you know, research that eventually is going to become more tangible. Can we publish in scientific journals? This is still a big issue. Do we have a supportive research community that can at some point say, yeah, what this guy is doing is important? And I have to say, I could only pursue this because on one hand, we had all these other tangibles, like machine learning algorithms and machine perception algorithms that kick butt and work really well. And then we could say, well, look at these things are also, at some point, these things are going to work, and you're going to need to look on the intangibles and how to put them together. And I have to say also, because an extraordinary research group at Sony that funded my research, they were in the forefront of social robotics, but they knew very well that the next step involved bringing robots into daily life and understanding how to put together perception and action. And perhaps because I didn't get tenure, and that also gave me some time that I didn't have to put into teaching, gave me some extra time so that I could, for example, immerse myself for hours and hours at ECEC, many times wondering, well, what am I doing here? But at the same time thinking, this is very important. I had the time to do that.
Eh? Changing diapers.
Changing diapers. And in fact, we had an engineer from Sony, and he also had to change diapers. And that was, we felt that when the teachers felt comfortable that we, and the parents felt comfortable that we could change the diapers of their kids, that we were doing something right.
And if you make a robot do that,
oh, yeah. So let me tell you about the timeline of the project. On year one, that was 2005, we had 60 field sessions. And we used a wizard of Oz paradigm that is just the fancy way of saying that there was a person behind the machine. Not always, I'll tell you, occasions where the robot was autonomous. And also that was risky because then people are going to say, well, this is not a real robot. But we also felt this was very important because what we wanted to do is to understand what are the kind of things that work, what are the things that we're going to need to develop in the near future so that we have autonomous robots. And the main point was that if a bunch of people kind of get together around a table and start brainstorming about what's important and what's not, very probably they're going to be wrong. And I'll give you examples of that later. And we felt it's very important just we immerse ourselves and figure out what are the important things to work on in the near future. Year two, we thought, OK, year one, we're going to do all these field sessions. Year two, we're going to have these amazing robots that solve all the problems. Turned out not to be that way. We ended up with 60 hours of video. We had no idea what to do with them. And in fact, the entire year went into analyzing those field sessions. And also, actually, we had identified some target things, particularly the development of what you can think of an API or a kind of an operating system that would allow us to solve the software problems in terms of integrating perception and action that we had already discovered in year one. And in year two, we've been focusing on autonomous behavior and using robots as a teaching platform. OK, so I'm going to tell you about this one. This is the analysis of the field sessions in year one. And so during that year, we had two robots. One was Ruby that we kind of developed by immersion. We kept changing it. And now we are actually on version 3 of Ruby that looks very different from this one based on our experience. And we had Curio, which is a really a mechanical marvel that was developed by Sony. And we had 45 field sessions with it. The way this was, we kind of organized the field sessions. We had Curio, which was controlled by a human. It has very human-like movements, and this is actually a very important part of its behavior. It really feels like it's human because of the way it moves. For example, it has some dancing moves, and he's so good that he has, once in a while he does this robot dancing thing, just because he doesn't really dance like a robot, he dances like a human. He's not very friendly looking, and he's not huggable at all. Then we had Robbie, which was kind of more friendly looking, but still clearly looked like a robot. And then we had Jeff, who looks very friendly and is very huggable, but was static. Okay, this is just a video of a day in the life of the Ruby project. Maybe we can turn off the lights a little bit now. So you can see the kind of things that Ruby could do. It can make some facial expressions, still very limited. It had a head with 3 degrees of freedom. And it had this monitor where it can actually, a touch screen where the children can actually, you can present materials to the children and the children can actually interact with Ruby. We had 3 cameras running simultaneously. One thing you'll notice in year one is that we were very involved and very kind of, we were very much part of the situation. In year three, the children are completely free to do whatever they want and we don't intervene. The wizard. He's Brett, he's now at Boston University. That's Curio. For the most part, we never put Ruby and Curio together. This was just because UCSD made this documentary of it. So, the dancing is actually autonomous. Okay. I think this kind of gives you an idea of what the day looked like. Then typically at the end of the day, we'll just get together and talk about what we had learned and made changes to Ruby accordingly. Okay, so let me tell you what I'm going to talk about. First, we're going to talk about evaluating social robot algorithms in the time scale of minutes, tracking the development of interaction in the time scale of months, and issue a fully automatic assessment of the quality of the interaction so that robots can actually have a signal that tells them, oh, I'm doing well, I'm socially connected or I'm not, and so eventually can learn on their own to interact with people. Then I'll talk about the lessons. Okay, so the first one is evaluation of social robot algorithms in the time scale of minutes. So we designed these experiments. Our goal was to, first of all, find methods to evaluate social robot algorithms outside the laboratory. In particular, we chose to evaluate two dancing algorithms, one choreography that had been put together by Sony, and then a simple optic flow-based dancing algorithm that we had put together. And then we also were interested in some parameters. For example, we wanted to know how long it takes for children to kind of lose interest on a very interesting task, but that is very repetitive. And the idea is that later on we wanted to use that to actually have controllers that decide when to present a new task because children are actually likely to be losing interest of the current activity. We also wanted to get an idea of how long is needed to provide useful data in these experiments that are run in daily life. I had experience running experiments on children, on infants, in a laboratory environment. I know that that takes months and still is very difficult. And it was unclear to me how long it would take to run a useful experiment in daily life. Would it take 3 months? Would it take 1 month? Would it take a few days? It wasn't clear, and we had this very interesting trade-off basically between variance and bias. The variance in the sense that we have more uncontrolled conditions when we moved into daily life. At the same time, we have less bias in the sense that we have more ecological validity. And it wasn't clear whether this would actually work effectively in daily life. All right, so we were evaluating these two algorithms. I'm going to show them to you. One was a choreography that looked really good. That was put together by Sony, and the other one was an algorithm that used optic flow from the camera to kind of produce some movements. So if it sees children moving, it kind of move and it's somewhat reactive to the children, although not perfectly. This is the choreography. Okay, and the next one is going to be the one that is closed loop. It reacts to the children somewhat. By the way, so here you see Robbie and Jeff, the other two control toys.
So,
yes.
In the paper you said the algorithm was based on optic flow, but I noticed it's moving its
yes.
head at the same time.
Yes,
so
yes. So it creates this boom calls. I forgot how he calls it, but basically, yeah, there is this closed loop where as you move, then you tend to keep moving because you're seeing yourself. And so that creates kind of a period of reverberation and some oscillations that look like dancing.
Yes,
that's right. So it's both.
It's moving.
Right, so it's both. First, so if you didn't have anything for a long period of time, it wouldn't move at all. The moment it sees somebody moving, it will react to the children. Movement, as it reacts to the children movement, is moving itself, so it keeps moving for a while. And you have this actually oscillation that looks like a dancing. And at some point, and I don't know the specifics of the algorithm, at some point the oscillation stops unless there is exterior flow. Okay, so we put a lot of time into figuring out how to analyze this data, and finally we converged into this method that has been used in marketing research, which is basically you have this running video and you have people just with a dial saying how good the interaction is between the children and the robot. We didn't know whether this was going to work or not. It's using marketing research. We said, well, maybe we can use it also. And as actually, the coders, they code independently, of course, and they can actually see a history of the past coding. I think it's the past 2 or 3 minutes, I forgot. Okay, so the experimental design, there were two dancing algorithms, the choreography and the optic flow one. 6 sessions, each with a different algorithm, randomly selected at each point in time. Each session had 20 repetitions of the same song. And I have to tell you, it was horrible. I was there for the 20 repetitions. And after two or three, it's really, your brain doesn't really like it. And the videos were evaluated by four independent coders, frame by frame, for quality of the interaction. Actually, I don't think it was real time. It was almost real time. We found that if you slow it down a little bit, we got better reliability between the different coders. All right, so here are some of the results. I really like this thing. This is the correlation between the four coders across the entire six sessions as a function of the smoothing that the temporal smoothing that we put on the evaluations of the coders. And the reasoning for that was, well, that evaluation that the coders are giving us is a combination of a signal, the true signal of what they really think, but there is also some noise to it. And the idea is, well, if we put some temporal smoothing, that's basically a low-pass filter that's going to get rid of that noise. And so we would expect that as we smooth more and more, basically, if the time window of the filter becomes smaller and smaller, it's more of a low, it passes less and less of the high-frequency information. As we smooth more and more, we get rid of noise, therefore the correlation should increase. But at some point, if we smooth too much, we get rid of the actual signal, and at that point the correlation should actually decrease. And that should actually give us an indication of how much of the past, basically, the coders were using to make their evaluations. When we say, well, tell me how good is the goodness of interaction, well, it's the last second, it's the last minute, it's the last hour. And so this technique actually gives us a sense of how much the coders were using to make their evaluation. Yes?
So while they're looking at the video, they're turning an analog dial?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
If it gets better, they turn it up.
That's right, that's right. That's right.
For the whole course of the interaction.
For the whole course of the interaction. Right. And so, you know, based on this, it seemed like people were basically, the time constant was in the order of 3 to 5 minutes, which it seems to be what people kind of put together or kind of integrate when creating these evaluations. Yes? Yes.
We were confused because you said it was over the last 4.5 minutes, but it seems to peak at like 2.5 on that graph.
Not really, no. I would say the peak is there. But yeah, I mean, it's...
You're tilting to the right as it comes
1, 2, 3. Oh, yeah. Look at it. Yeah, you have a point. I mean, it really is a range. And I said between 3 and 5, maybe it's more... Let's see, this is
so
3.
I
would say the peak is a 3.
I didn't know if that corresponded to the actual width of the, you know, of the high peak point in the window, or because it's just the smoothing constant, and it may correspond to a window that extends back around 4.5 minutes.
It's an exponential smoother, so it's kind of the equivalent of a window that extends in the past for about 3 minutes. And we're saying 3 to 5. I don't know if I want to make too much of a deal about what the peak is. I'm happy with something that says it's in the order of a few minutes.
So if you look at overall at a 10-minute segment, you're sort of judging over a 3-minute sliding window frame?
That's what appears to be happening. That when you ask people in this very open-ended manner, what they seem to be doing is kind of keeping track of the last 3 to 5 minutes. We have very high inter-observer reliability in the order of 0.8 in Pearson correlation. Then we learned that within sessions, we had this is the time within a session. This is the goodness score. And it decreased with a time constant again of about 4 minutes. So every 4 minutes, the interaction drops by about 30%. It also decreased from session to session. So between sessions, one and a half sessions gives you a drop of about 30% also. And those are important parameters that we can use later to put together controllers that try to minimize a lack of interest. We didn't find significant difference between the dancing algorithms. And later, I should tell you that what we're thinking now is that, in fact, the dancing algorithm is not that important, that there is another thing that is much more important than the specific dancing algorithm. And I'll tell you about that later. And but perhaps one of the, to me, most important lessons is how efficient these immersive experiments are, that in 6 days you can get so much and so beautiful data. I was very surprised about. And my interpretation of this is the following. If you enter the room there and they don't know, the kids don't know you, you create a completely different environment. The kids, the children are gonna, you create this humongous, intervention that's gonna have an effect in some children, different from others. Some children are gonna behave in one way, some in another. So in fact, by bringing children to a laboratory also, you think that you're bringing them to controlled conditions, and that's right, but you're creating this, you're taking them out of their environment and you're increasing the variability, potentially, of how they behave. So in order to kind of reduce that variability, you need more subjects, you need more time. We were there, apparently it looks like a chaotic situation, but that's really the way, it was a daily life situation for these children, and they behaved the way they were. So in a way, you can claim, we haven't tested this, that maybe, even though it looks chaotic, in fact, you actually end up with less noisy conditions than what you have in a laboratory environment. Okay, so of course I'm preaching to the choir here, but right? You know, ethnographers and ethologists know very well the importance of this. I was raised as an experimental psychologist. The way I saw this is, well, yes, ethnographers do that, they have less biased conditions, but I was very much trained on the idea that, but we have more control, you know, we can, we reduce variance. And now I'm really questioning that also, as to whether, in fact, you reduce variance, it appears like, but in fact, you may actually be introducing other sources of variability. Okay, so the second one was tracking the development of the interaction between the children and the robots. And this was very important for us because we know, and Sony knew, that, for example, they had this line of the Aibo product, which is this robot, this dog robot. Initially, I think it was like $5,000. It went down to $1,000 or so. It kept getting better and better, and by the time that the Aibo product started making money, Sony decided to cut it because they decided that they better focus on TVs and the classical things that they do. But in any case, one of the things they knew is that people bought these products, and after 10 hours, except for some people that really got hooked on them, on average, after 10 hours, people would put them back in the box, and that was it. And so we kept talking about this 10-hour barrier. And what does it take to break this 10-hour barrier when we know that children and adults are capable of having these long-term interactions with their pets? I think we have an example here of an adult that has a very long-term interaction with his pet. So we decided to focus on touching behaviors because by observing the videos, it's really felt that the touch was very informative, it was relatively easy to code, and so on. So what I'm gonna do now is show you, you probably seen it in this, in the paper, show you the evolution of some of the categories of behaviors that we felt were important to track the development of the interaction between the children and Curio. So the first one was hugging. Oh, and this is wrong. This is sweets, I'm sorry. This one should be there, and Curio is here. And so, first of all, we were, first thing, in other classrooms, Jeff, which is very huggable and has the appearance of being, you know, a very friendly toy, was, the children really liked to hug it and so on, but when we brought this to, in all the sessions that we run, basically was completely ignored. So I'm gonna put the icon to remind you that it was there. But you're gonna see nothing there because they pretty much completely ignored it. Yes?
We were talking during the earlier student session, wondering yes. Whether the children had access to all of the toys during the time that Curio wasn't active.
No.
So including the soft cuddly ones?
Yes. So this was tested, piloted in an earlier classroom, and it seemed like I don't want to make a big deal of it. It just seemed like the children really liked it because it's cuddly and colorful. But the sessions that we ran, we put the toys there and we took them out at the end of the session. Yes?
But in the video, they were interacting with other toys, like they had trucks and stuff.
Yes, that's right. So you saw Jeff was there, and
right.
You know, we didn't really observe them hugging it, for example, or anything like that, yeah. Oh, yeah, they do have a bunch of other toys. Yes.
You don't want to force them to have, right, limited.
Right, but I'm just wondering, even if it's a control toy,
yeah.
There's a bunch of other toys, too.
Yes, but what our interest really is on tracking the difference between the interaction between this one and that one. And this one, we didn't really care about the other toys. What do you think could be interesting about tracking the interaction with all the other? First of all, it would be, at some point you can't because it's very difficult, but what do you think could be gained from that?
Well, if you're comparing these three things, then either the other toys shouldn't be there or the other toys should be tracked, I guess. And maybe you don't need Jeff, maybe you can talk about the other toys and the whole toys.
Well, the other toys, I would say, is just like other things, right? I would say you can track them if you're going to gain some information. It's not clear to me that you're going to get information, because what we really care is about tracking how behavior, you know, how the interaction developed towards these two toys, particularly really towards Curio. For example, I don't really care with how interaction develops towards some, you know, car toy or something like that. Yeah.
But they have access to those other toys all the time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's what I find kind of interesting about it, that they would choose to play with a truck instead of a robot when the robot is there for a limited period of time.
Yeah. Okay, so.
So another. I wasn't clear on one answer. So when you did the pilot with Jeff, is it?
Yeah.
Different kids,
yeah.
Different kids, okay.
So it's also possible that these kids just didn't like this toy.
And maybe this is jumping ahead, but one other thing you said in the paper was that when Curio was around, they interacted with Robbie more.
Yes.
Than when Curio wasn't around, which suggests you had Robbie there without Curio.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't know now whether Robbie. Why you laugh? I don't know the answer to that. It's possible that we had these two during the Ruby sessions, but the truth is I don't remember, but it should be easy to look in the videos. There were 15 more Ruby sessions with Ruby. Why do I have that feeling? But because that feeling is a really strong one.
I mean, you said it in the paper, so I figured you must have some data to back it up.
No. And no, I don't have data. Okay, so now we're working on the weaknesses of this approach, right? The weakness is this is not experimental. This is an observational study, meaning that we go there. Our goal, really, the way we want to be evaluated is, do we generate fruitful hypotheses that later can be studied in an experimental manner? So, for example, we had no idea that the children were going to become interested, particularly interested on Robbie, when we introduced Curio. We had not anticipated that, but it felt that way. And I mean, if you were there, we all would agree, what the heck? All of a sudden, they're becoming interested in Robbie, right? And they look at Curie and they go and pick Robbie. Now, how do you prove that? I don't know. I don't have any data to prove that. It was more of a kind of intuitive feeling that I wanted to put there, that was happening. We have, basically, it felt very much like this displacement effects, right, that ethologists talk about, in that it appeared that the way subjectively it appeared, and I know I'm in big trouble by saying these things, but that's the way it felt, is that the children wanted to have Curio, but they were afraid of Curio because it was moving and there was this unknown entity, and then they really displaced their behaviors toward Robbie. But I have some videos that when you look at them, some people say, oh, it's very clear, and some people say, well, so at this point I just say this is a hypothesis. Yes, Morana.
I know that you have very clean data when you first introduced Ruby and Robbie at the same moment.
Oh, so Robbie was there during the Ruby?
In the second year.
Okay, on the second year, okay.
First day, you introduced both Ruby and
Robbie. And Robbie, okay.
And the kids were exactly, when they were a little bit uncertain about the robot, Ruby, they went to touch Robbie.
Yeah.
And were constantly monitoring.
Right.
The other robot,
So it really feels like that, and I can maybe put together a video that really we would agree. Of course, it's very difficult to get in the mind of the child and see what's happening. We could do an experiment where, in fact, we do that. Yes, check how much Robbie is touched, to kind of establish a baseline. Then we bring Curio and see what happens. Again, that was not really the focus of our work. The focus of our work is develop, you know, good robots. So, but we generated this hypothesis that could be tested in the future.
And there, in that example, Robbie was definitely not introduced to this group of kids before. It just happened at that point.
Yeah. I know that Robbie was not introduced before. What I don't know is whether he was introduced with.
With
Curio. Why do I say that the children treated very differently Robbie when it was in the, I don't know. I'll try to reconstruct that. Okay, but this is the hugging behavior. So you see that they hugged it very much and then it went down. With Curie, it takes some time, and actually this is very important. This is when things started to warm up between Curio and the children, and I'll tell you a little bit about what it took to do that. And in the end, the most huggable toy was not hugged at all. The intermediate huggable toy was hugged so-so, and the least huggable was hugged the most. So that's an example of a spontaneous hug. Notice, though, it's somewhat of a strange hug, right? They go from behind. Then again, it's difficult to hug this robot from the front because it's so small and it's doing so. They certainly, even though they really became attached to Curio, they always treated it as some kind of a entity that deserves special attention.
Is it metal or plastic?
It's plastic, yeah. Caretaking behaviors were seldom observed towards Robbie, but happened even very early on towards Curio, particularly when Curio ran out of batteries. The children established this routine where they would say night night and put a blanket on Curio. These type of things never happened with Jeff. I should also say it would be a mistake to just think of the children and Curio as a single entity. This was an entire classroom, and you know, maybe the children would say night night, and then the teachers would say, "Oh, Curio night night," and then that became a game that was became a routine for the entire classroom. And there are also very good examples of that. This is a very good example of the effect of the entire classroom and not just the individual. Rough housing, this referred to behaviors that, you know, we said if you do them to a human being, they would be too violent. And it would entail things like grabbing Robbie from the head and just moving it around. So things that you would say, you don't do that to a human being. That happened a lot with Robbie. Again, Jeff was ignored, and it never happened to Curio. I should say, though, there were sometimes where the children, okay, and this is an example of what I was telling you about the effect of the entire classroom. The children would sometimes, point at Curio's eyes because they were very beautiful with blue LEDs. And when that happened, the teachers would say, no, you don't do that. And we would tell the teachers, no, don't worry, nothing happens. And the teachers would say, no, you don't do that. We don't want the children to learn that. The funny thing is that the teachers never complain about the rough housing to Robbie, okay? Same also with falling. I think that is, falling down. So, Robbie kept falling down once in a while. Early on, Curio, fell down quite a few times. And because the children were like moving from one place to another, so once in a while it would just fall, because it's much less stable than a child. What happened in those situations were quite dramatic for the children. If it fell, they felt very bad. Some children sometimes cry. And so we kept telling them, don't worry about it, it's okay. Curio's okay, don't worry. And again, at some point the teacher said, no, don't tell them it's okay. Because then they may learn that it's okay to push other children. So just say that Curio is okay, but don't say it's okay to push. Again, they never complain about Robbie. I have to admit there was a very dramatic, I wasn't there, but I heard that it was very dramatic that one time Curio fell and his head popped out. And we rapidly had to put it together. Yes?
So rough housing is more antisocial than rough?
Oh, no, it wasn't really antisocial at all. It was more like...
The eyes would be an example.
Yes, but... maybe that's a bad word. What it really meant is that they were not treating this object as if it were a social object.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't call it antisocial in the sense that it didn't feel. It's a toy. And they're just treating it as a toy. But if that were a baby, that would be a very bad thing to do to a baby, right? The poking, they were very careful. I wouldn't call it antisocial. They were really careful about it. And once the children, so we didn't count it as rough housing. So
you didn't call it rough housing.
We didn't call it rough housing. It's not there. Because it really was more like they were, it didn't feel like they was doing like that.
But the teacher thought it was violent.
The teacher said, we don't want the children to do that. Another interesting one is touching with objects. It happened a lot towards Curio, mostly because they were trying to give things to Curio, even though Curio wasn't really capable of getting things. Okay, so another thing we did is studying where did the children, and how much did the children touch Curio? And what we found was this kind of bell-shaped curves. Now, first thing I have to tell you, this does not indicate at all that the children were becoming more interested and then less interested. As time went by, it was very apparent that the children were becoming more and more interested and interacted better and better on Curio. And we said, well, so what is this, why are we having this shape? I should say, first of all, at about this point, we introduced a contingency between the children's behavior and the robot behavior. And it was a very simple one. And the reason we did that is that Curio wasn't just cutting it with the children. It was moving around, it was a great robot, but there was no interaction developing with the children. And so we decided, well, it's not giving them anything. The first thing you notice when you go to this childcare center is that the children actively give you something, and then you give it back, and then they give you again to you, they give it back, and then boom, the behavior, there is a relationship established. Those kind of things couldn't happen. There was no giving back and forth. So we said, well, why don't we just make a very simple contingency so that when they touch, Curio giggles. And it had a humongous effect, and from that day, really, the interaction really moved in a different direction. I should also say that, no, I'm not going to say that. Another thing, so we were also kind of curious about why all these behaviors go up and down, but this one keeps going up, touching of the arm and hand. So we decided to study, well, where do children actually touch each other? Oh, here is the, that's the contingency. So again, it was very important, and again, it involved the entire classroom. It's inevitable. You're there. They touch Curio. They laugh, and they look at you, and you laugh. And I should say also, like on year two, Morana was there. We tried some studies where we were saying, well, to what extent we're having an influence here? So what if? You know, we just stay there, don't do anything. And that was very problematic because if you don't behave naturally, then all of a sudden you're kind of creating this humongous effect. So for example, at one point we did a study where Curio would move and respond to them. And Morana has these pictures where the children are touching Curio, they go, ah! They look at me, they go, ah! And I'm like, you know, nothing's going on. And they go like, What is going on here, right? So I completely break the situation. So in fact, that was not like being neutral. It was really having an effect on things. So anyway, so we studied where they touch each other, and sure enough, they touch each other most on the arm and hand. So we kind of one way of interpreting this is that in fact they were converging more and more towards touching Curio the way they touch each other. You know, I don't. That's bad statistics. I only do good statistics. That's an improper.
Okay,
I really want to just say this in a qualitative manner, which is that it's converging or it's looking that it moves more towards that distribution.
Well, it's very. What's interesting is like the head is the lowest, and the head is the lowest for the kids.
Yes.
I'm
not ready. I don't really want to make a quality. I think we look at the numbers and they look pretty good, but I felt it really, that's not what we're trying to do, you know. So what if it is not like that? What we're trying to say, what we're trying to say is we're converging to that.
It'd be good to have that table in the paper with the last numbers at 45.
Well, maybe one thing that we could do is the difference between the distributions as a function of time, and so that it gets better and better. That's why we're saying that it's getting better. We're not claiming that it's exactly the same, but it's getting towards that. And look, at my impression is that you can see that already. So, but yeah, it may be helpful. So the third thing is automatic assessment of goodness of interaction. And so the idea is, can we predict this subjective impression of the quality of the interaction in a manner that robots could actually have access to? So they have access to an ongoing assessment of their social connectedness, how well they're doing. And again, since touch seemed to be so important, we decided to use touch sensing. We pass it through a low-pass filter that gives us that 3 to 5 minute time scale. That it failed to be important. We put a delay because we optimize the delay because it takes about 1 second for humans to actually react on their dial to the events. And we actually did find that the optimal delay was about 1 second.
3 seconds.
Was it 3 seconds? Really, that's what I say?
Yeah.
All right, I believe it. And then we just scale this. So we just, okay. And Gary recently asked me, well, did you try other things? We try models with different weights given to each of the sensors. We try models with just one sensor, two sensors, and so on. And basically, this one with equal weight to all the sensors did very well. The differences with more complicated models were really minor, and so we decided that this is such a simpler model that was good enough for us. And we were getting correlations with humans in the order of 0.79, just about as good as human-to-human reliability. So, of course, we were concerned. And is what if the coders confabulated into counting the number of touches, even though they did not really relate to the quality of the interaction, right? Well, the first question is, well, why touches? They could have confabulated on something else. But we went back to the videos, and at least while we're never going to be able to reject that hypothesis, at least we felt that, okay, no, it seems like something really important is going on. So this is an example of a session, 45 minutes. The dots represent the individual observer evaluations. The blue continuous line is the average of the four observers. And the red line is the prediction made by the touch model, not training just in this session, but training all the sessions. And as you can see, first of all, the prediction is really amazing, that just with touch you can actually predict so well this human judgment. Then what we did is went back to situations that had high quality of interaction. And this is, for example, a situation where they're taking care of curio and scored their touching curio. This one was a situation where they were doing the giggly game. They touch curio, curio teaches, giggles back to them. This is a case which was evaluated as low goodness of interaction, and pretty much curio was on its own. And this is the end, the goodness interaction went up, and they were playing the night-night game. So at least to our satisfaction, we felt that yes, really there is, in these sessions, there is a very strong correlation between touch and social connectedness between the children and curio. And again, in our case, what we have to do really is now, we're using that fact to develop algorithms that use touch as evaluated to, here to for robots to evaluate how well they're doing. So some wild speculations. Is early social development, is the structure of early social interaction set up so that touch happens to be a very good indicator of connectedness? That seems to be the case in the sessions that we saw. It may very well be the case in early child development. If so, you would expect that the brain may actually have structures that keep track of touch in the time scale of minutes, and that in fact touch may be used as a reinforcement signal. It's also interesting to think, well, if that's the case, then how does it evolve into adult interaction? And I remember talking with Cynthia Brazil, and she said that there was this ethnographer that claimed that speech basically is evolved from grooming and touch. That in fact, when we talk to each other, it's like we're touching each other. I thought, okay, that kind of looks cool. But I do really wonder about the importance and what the time scale is in adult interaction. And the things that we're pursuing now, of course, is can we use that self-evaluation of goodness of interaction or social connectedness to have robots that learn to interact with people? And I will tell you a little bit about the work that Cynthia, one of our grad students, is doing on this. How about Ruby? I didn't tell you anything about Ruby. But I want to show you a video about the role of timing on the emergence of social behaviors. One, the first example I gave you is if we put a delay between a subject making a facial expression and an agent responding to that, it feels like like it feels like the agent is alive, otherwise it feels mechanical. So that's an example. Here is another one. We were, with Ruby, once in a while we observed the children looking at Ruby, but overall it felt that they were focusing on the monitor. So we were concerned, like, oh, are we becoming kind of a portable TV type of thing, an appliance? And so we actually brought some, you know, so one way of looking at this is that the children were behaving towards Ruby in an autistic manner, meaning they were not looking at Ruby's eyes. I have to say also that I felt that way myself, that it's like, gee, I'm not looking at Ruby's head. It's like, is it relevant? Why do we have a head there at all? And some of the students were actually saying that. So we brought this person from Laura Schreiman's lab, a specialist on autism, and he saw the interaction and he gave us some clues on things that we could do to train the children to look at Ruby. Like reinforce them when they look at Ruby, make a beep when they look at Ruby, this type of thing. And nothing of that seemed to work. Then one day, we discovered that there was a bug on the face servos, on the head servos for Ruby, and we discovered that, and then all of a sudden we could make her move quicker. And that very day, when we got Ruby to move her head in a quicker manner, for the first time, we observed dramatic pointing behaviors and shared attention behaviors, which I want to show you now. And I want you to see first, those attention are really beautiful, and also to see that when you observe Ruby, that it really feels like she's looking at things, that she is alive, and it didn't feel like that before. So first, I'm going to just show you the kind of the keyframes. So Tyler is, oh, I shouldn't say names. The child is pointing for Ruby to look at something, checks whether Ruby.
Name of the movie.
But that's not the real name. Checks for Ruby whether she's looking at there. Turns out Ruby's looking at another place, then he checks what's going on there. Okay, and this is the video.
That is the man behind the curtain.
Yeah. This is being
twisting your head around.
Yeah, this is being controlled by a person. So that, of course, that's another factor. But he was there before, and he tried very hard to produce these behaviors, and he couldn't. But I don't want to make, again, this is just a hypothesis that emerged out of the study. And obviously, experiments can be done to see the effect of the speed of movement on generation of these behaviors. Okay, so let me give you some conclusions. Children bonded and socialized with Curio. As time progressed, they treated Curio more like they treat each other. Touch played a very important role, and we see that because of the simple touch sound contingency helped develop social behaviors. Touch was a very good indicator of the quality of interaction, and the touch behaviors seem to converge to the touch behaviors to each other. Let me tell you some of the lessons. The immersive design helped us in many ways. For example, Sony developed this mechanical wonder, but completely underestimated the importance of touch. And this became very clear once we immersed ourselves into this environment. Yesterday, I had a call from a CEO of a new social robotics company, and he told me, oh, we just got together with all the engineers, and we decided to dump touch because we don't think it really is important, and we're going to focus on computer vision. And I started laughing, and he said, oh, this is great, I have to put it in my talk. it helped us develop a really good smile detector that's coming soon to a mall near you, courtesy of Sony, and that works really good. And, oh, I should say, why that happened? Okay, there's a very nice story on this. So we were working on these expression recognizers, including smile. We used the standard databases that everybody uses, and we were doing great. It was just fantastic, the best smile detector there ever was. We put it on Ruby, and it was horrible. It just would not work at all. And that's when I said, well, it's not working. And it really was very good feedback. It took getting rid of those databases because we felt they were not informative, and collecting a new database of 70,000 images from the web with many races, many illumination conditions, and now we have a detector that works really well in those conditions. So that was a very important lesson to us. And it also made us wonder about models that rely on the established data sets to make claims about how, you know, expression recognition works, because they may be capitalizing on things that do not generalize very well. But maybe not, but I'm just bringing this as a possibility. And it helped us get the Science of Learning Center in many ways. One is because NSF really liked the Ruby project, and otherwise that it really highlighted timing as a very important scientific problem that had not been studied well enough. The negatives is that we still keep falling between the cracks of the scientific community. And roboticists say, well, you know, this is not robotics. And social scientists say, well, this is not scientific enough. And so we do have this problem. But hopefully, it will pay off in the long run. So things that are happening now, we're focusing on continuous autonomous operation. Our goal for this year is 1 week of continuous operation, completely autonomous. So far, we've gotten 3 days, and we're very, very happy about that. And I have to tell you another very interesting thing is that for the first time, we had a mother express concerns that her child is maybe playing too much with the robots. So in a way, this is a very important concern that we're very sensitive to, but we're like, yes! Because, and this is something I really told my students, when we started this year, and you remember, we went there with our robots, and you know, we have all these great ideas, and we go there, we bring the robot, and the children play with it for 5 minutes, and then they leave. And you see these, you know, very sad grad students and professors saying, gee, you know, they don't like my robot. And then you get these very nice explanations, well, children don't have a long attention span, obviously, blah, 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 and it's, yeah, it kind of sounds reasonable. But now our problem is that they have too much attention span. All of a sudden, they just keep playing and playing with the robots. So that wasn't a good explanation. And I always tell them, remember the bad days, because when we have the good days, it's going to seem obvious, and it's going to seem like so easy. But it wasn't easy. I promise to you, it was very, very tough to get where we are. We are focusing now on teaching. And so the robot presents materials to the children in the form of games. Timing is a very important thing. So Cynthia, one of our students, is focusing on the issue of when to present a game for teaching, when to start it, and when to stop it. And again, she's developing a controller that uses touch as an indicator of whether or not she's doing well. We're also focusing on the recognition of mood and mood transitions. So, and this is where I wanted to tell you something about dancing. This year, we had a new robot, and we created a simple dancing algorithm, and it worked quite OK. And then the teachers told us, oh, if you did this and if you did that, it's going to be great. And we agreed, so we put the weekend on to developing this better dancing algorithm. So on Friday, we had this really great dancing algorithm. Well, this dancing algorithm that worked pretty well. Then the teachers told us this, and we felt, oh, well, let's change. Make the changes in the weekend. Go back to school, we're all like, oh, now it's going to be amazing. And nothing worked. OK, so on Friday, there was a little bit of dancing. The moment it was a little bit of dancing, the teachers came in and started clapping. We saw the children and the teachers clapping, and we were so happy. So we started kind of dancing, and everything went very well. Monday. We have this great dancing algorithm, but the children are not really doing much. The teachers are completely, they couldn't care less. They're here and there is Monday, forget it. And we are like so sad because nothing is working. And so the mood was not there. And the more you try to push that dancing thing, the worse it really was. So what we're learning is what is really critical is not to have a great dancing algorithm, what is really critical is to know when you should dance. And both, and so we're really focusing on that problem, kind of recognizing what the mood is and moving with the mood, maybe control it or maybe just adapting to it. And of course, as for the first time, we feel that it's already time to focus on evaluation, so we're doing double-blind studies to study the effectiveness of the robot as a teacher. And that's it. Thank you. Milliseconds. Yeah.
And do you think that you can get to a resolution here with the kids that it would be?
I would say things, effects like the speed of movement of the head, that's probably, it's going to be probably, you know, fractions of seconds. And so it's something between the fraction of seconds that, you know, timing, that's the kind of timing that, you know, seems critical for having this sense of, oh, this magic that, oh, so this thing is responding to me. Yes?
So two broad questions in different directions. I really would like to know what your IRB statement looks like.
Yes. That was very, so that was the kind of thing I could do because I don't have tenure. I knew this was going to be a big issue. I also actually I also was extremely worried about how this was going to be perceived by the parents. So even if we pass the IRB, we may end up with only one or two parents saying, yes, I'm okay with this. So I was very concerned about that. And because of that, we had this period where we went to ECC and just volunteered and changed diapers and get to know the parents and heard them. And they were really, to my surprise, incredibly supportive. I think the fact that they knew us and they trusted us and the fact that they, of course, these are parents that are affiliated with UCSD, so they are researchers or staff members, and they felt that they were contributing to science. That really helped, and in the end, they were so happy that then we had a story with Wired magazine, we gave them a video. I mean, it was really, especially on year one, it was kind of like a big party. IRB, well, we had the full support of ECEC, and I guess that helped. The fact that especially Curio is so non-threatening, Ruby wasn't moving, so you know we had always a safety person there. So, and as time goes by, you know, we're kind of establishing that everything is okay. So,
the other question has to do with cultural differences, roles of these semi engaging devices in this country as opposed to Japan.
Yes. So yeah, that's a great question because what everybody says, and there is some truth to it, that Japanese culture and religious beliefs are more compatible, and it's, and also their experience with the role of robots in their society is more compatible in Japan than here. In particular, the fact that there is absolutely no problem for a Japanese person to think that something has a little bit of life. You know, so this gradedness in life, that's completely not a problem. And whereas maybe the Judeo-Christian culture, we worry about, well, is this alive or not? And that's just not an issue for them. There are some really interesting things like, I'm not sure whether I don't tell this to anybody, but at some point, for tax reasons, many robots at a famous company in Japan had to be destroyed. And the people that destroyed them went to a temple afterwards to say sorry and ask for forgiveness. Because it's actually very hard not to feel that these things are to some extent alive. Okay, so I can put together a very nice story, and people have put together those stories. Okay, so based on that also, I was kind of feeling, well, it's gonna be horrible here, right? It's not gonna work. The idea of bringing robots and, but it wasn't like that. And you know, the moment you explain to parents what this was about and the safety mechanisms that we had and all that, I had all the support in the world, and it was actually an active support rather than a passive support. So I don't know to what extent I wanna, you know, I buy into those explanations. I don't know.
Is there any chance that you could replicate the experiments you're doing here with a set of children there to see? If
in Japan? Actually, I started, this experiment started because I did that in Japan first.
Yeah.
And so what I felt in Japan, it was much more like, yeah, the parents agree, but it felt a little bit more like passive, okay, they're telling me to do this, I'm gonna do it, okay. But here I felt more the parents were more actively really asking questions and suggesting things that the robot could do and so on. But this is just an impression. So I'm not sure, what I would be more interested in is not what the current beliefs are in, say, one culture versus another, but the capacity to change those beliefs. What I found is that, you know, at least at ECC, parents were able to change their attitude towards this. I don't know what their previous attitude was, but I'm going to say the prior is that this would be negative. I will have a negative attitude towards study like this with my children. But they changed when they saw that the right mechanisms were there. Also, another thing is robots really helped Japan in terms of getting more jobs, whereas here they really help in terms of losing jobs. So you still see that a little bit. Like, for example, I went recently to New Haven, and the taxi driver asked me, what do you work on? And I say, oh, robots. Oh, robots, I have robots. Robots. They are going to take all our jobs. You would never hear something like that in Japan.
But I'm thinking about earlier experiences, too, with what are the little pets you had just scratched their belly periodically or they would die.
Oh, the Tamagotchis.
Tamagotchis, right. So
they keep kicking. My son and my daughter recently got one of those, and they're hooked on them.
In the market, they were much more successful in Japan.
Or was it? Certainly, they have the prior is very... They love robots in Japan. They have a culture of robots. The prior is there. But I also see that Americans are very willing to, you know, give it a try. They're just more. They have a healthy attitude, I would say, towards robots. They want to know before they do something. They want to know, is this the thing to do? Yes.
Do you think eye contact would add any information beyond the touch to predicting goodness of the internet?
Yeah.
Oh,
eye contact. Yeah, I would say it's very, probably it's going to be very important. The surprising thing is that something as simple as touch also works very well. Proximity, I mean, there are many things that are going to correlate with touch, right? Proximity also correlates with touch. I'm sure it's also very important. It's just that touch already is a good indicator of all these other things.
And it might be a very interesting developmental trajectory.
Yes.
Chris Johnson left because she did on bonobos showing this pathway from touch to eye out into the world, and it might be interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in that experiment, the quality of interaction was determined by a handful of UCSD undergraduates, right?
Was evaluated, yeah.
Yeah, so did these people have any particular background, like taken any classes in social development?
No.
So,
they were. Well, first of all, you make a good point. We're just trying to get a inexpensive sample of the average human or the typical human perception. Okay, if each undergraduate student had been all over the place, they didn't agree with each other, and they didn't agree on other things. So this is one of the things where they did agree. Then that's an indicator that maybe. There is something here, and you know, and every time that we do studies like this, we get four people. Every time it's different people, and we get similar levels of reliability. Now, let me make a point. We don't know what they were using. It's very likely that they were using things like eye contact and proximity and all these other things. Only thing we're saying is that in this particular type of interactions, as they happen in the early childhood education center, touch was a very good predictor. It's not cause, it's a good predictor of kind of an amalgamation of all these other things. From a machine perception point of view, it's like, oh, this is great, because that way I don't have to solve all these very difficult problems. And then that also brought me the idea, well, you know, if I had to put together a human brain, I would also, that develops, I would also say, I'm going to rely on the very easy things rather than the difficult things to give this brain a sense of social connectedness. That's the hypothesis, that maybe touch has a computational role in the sense that it's much easier to process than auditory signals and vision, for example. But yeah, that's always going to be an issue. But in a way, think of it this way. We're not as interested on an expert buying curious. We're interested about the average person buying curious. The important thing being that the average person, the perception that the average person has of this is also very important, of course. Yes. No. Yes. And for example, and it's obvious in many cases. So, for example, they miss these pointing things. They actually ranked. It was ranked as it's pretty good, but not that good. And of course, I see that. I'm like, oh my God! Look at what's happening. So yes, there are things like that. Yeah. But I'm of the belief that touch is a very good first approximation. Yes.
So, what is the crucial difference between Wally and Ibo? So why will we take care of a dog or something?
Ibo versus what's Wally?
Wally.
Oh.
Not a meal dog.
Yeah. Yes. Eh? Please. Well, that's the scientific question. That is the scientific question. What is the difference?
Please.
Of course, if you knew the difference, you know, I mean, Sony was very interested in learning what the difference was, because, and they tried many things. They tried, for example, well, maybe we put a little bit of randomness so that it appears that it's, that didn't work at all. But they were moving in the right direction. If you see the Aibos, they were getting better and better. I was very impressed with the latest ones. And one of the things they had is touch, you know, so you could touch them here. And it was not a click anymore. It was more like a pad like this. You touch them here, and they reacted to you. And I felt that they were really getting it right. So.
You say that in the past tense. Have they stopped making
Aibos? Oh yeah. So they stopped making Aibos. They stopped the robotics group was dissolved because they felt that they need to focus on the things that, you know, make money right now. That this was a distraction. But to my surprise, they keep funding me, which I'm very happy and proud of. So I'm, at this point, the last bastion of... So they haven't completely given up, and they really know more than anybody out there, including MIT and anybody out there, on what it takes. So
there's no more curios out there on the market either?
Well, they were never on the market. They were never on the market, but the Aibos were on the market, and they were starting to make money. But, you know.
Why would they put them on the run? I mean, maybe that's why they're not making any money on
what, on Curio?
Yeah.
Well, they would cost $150,000. So. So you would say, why would you pay $150,000? Some people would pay $150,000 because it's so cool, but, you know, after a few minutes,
later,
a few minutes, you would just put it back. And
but they only have to sell a few.
Eh?
They only have to sell a few.
Yeah, so that was, and they made the business decision that wasn't going to work. So.
Were they intentionally made to look robot-like? I mean, did they have, like, fur?
Yes. Yes, that was intentionally, and they actually intentionally made it look a little bit scary-like. And we saw that in the children. You know, it's like, it's scaring the children. The original version.
I think he's talking about
Curio. It's taken Ariba or Curio?
Curio.
Oh, so with Curio. So the original version of Curio was based on a Disney-like character, you know, was Disney-like and apparently just looked lame. And at least to the, you know, to the culture of engineers and so on, it looked a little lame. So they decided to base it on a character that was very scary and then make it a little bit less scary. And that's how we end up looking the way it looked. It had no facial expressions. That was a big mistake. We tried putting facial expressions later, and that looked horrible. You know, it had no touch. So it was really a mechanical wonder. But in terms of social interaction, it had very little.
Well, not just looks, but also the texture of it. Like,
you know, that actually is a very interesting thing. If you put, say, hair and, you know, make it lovable and so on, you also get other things. You have this kind of uncanny valley type of thing, because then when it moves, it looks mechanical, but it has this hairy thing. And so they try some things, and it's true that they look a little bit freaky. And it's, you go and say, well, you know, it's a robot. So they're very interesting things. It's kind of like artistic, right? It's really an important kind of art-like thing. So.
Oh, artistic.
Artistic.
You were talking about
autistic?
Yeah.
You have to. You have to learn English. Just have an accent. Yes?
Just to support the point of what he looks like, I forget, I'm going to tell him. Toshimura, I think is his name, the Japanese android manufacturer who can make really realistic lifelike. There was, I guess it was just Wired maybe 5 issues ago.
Yeah, that's like the, it's the so-called uncanny valley thing. I was actually in one of these very good, Hiroshi Seguro is supposed to have the best android out there, and I went to see it, and it was this lady in the middle of a room surrounded by grad students, and he looked really strange, like this secretary-looking lady, you know, surrounded by grad students, and then, you know, it's very strange. So you touch her here, for example, and she would put some pressure back. Sometimes she would just have a reflex and do like this, and sometimes she just put some pressure back. And I felt, you know, I felt, wow, this is amazing. You know, I mean, it really, first of all, you felt like weird, right? Like this person is alive. And you can't stop but feeling that way. And at the same time, I was thinking, gee, how they do this? This is really difficult. But it turns out that all they do is they just have, instead of using electrical servos, they have pneumatic servos. So they just push back. There's, you know, so the intelligence was in the air. It triggers on you all these, you know, feelings of what are they, I was feeling, what are they doing to you? Why are they doing this to you? This is not right. These type of things, it felt very much like a person that didn't have a cortex but otherwise was alive.
So have you thought about looking at interspecies
interactions, just to get, you know, two different species, slightly different time scale, how do they get coordinated? And maybe there would be some insight or some...
I think so, yeah. And things like grooming and things like that, right? It's, that's about touching, right? Yeah. But, you know, to
do a bird and a human, or a bird and... Oh, interaction between, the pets, the... Oh, okay, okay.
What about Curios raising a dog, right? Blow the whistle and tell the dog.
There we go.
So I don't understand your question.
Well, right. The question is, how do you get a human and a robot to get coordinated in a way that would be as natural as a human interacting with another human? So you have two different species, slightly different timescale, and you're trying to get them to coordinate. Now, there are quite amazing coordinations getting between horses and dogs, parrots and dogs, ravens and... Or even just people with each.
Yeah, people with different types of pets. Yeah.
Slightly different, and they get coordinated, and they learn from it, and they learn to look at where they need to look or react to what they need to react. So I think there's just an interesting arena to explore.
Yeah, something I like the idea of doing this in the classroom, and I think there's a lot you can do with that. But something I worry about is just the complexity. I mean, something I've persons
yes.
at all, because classrooms have such various personalities. And
yes.
so I wonder, it seems like it's hard enough to get a robot who's really good at social interaction with the child. But then once you get the group and the classroom dynamics into it, it just seems like there's so much tremendous adaptability that's necessary that most people are really bad at it, even though we're good at being social with one another.
Yeah, so one thing we learn is not that, I think that's a great point. It took us several years to learn not to have expectations. And
but then you get a lot of surprises that you never thought.
Yeah, so it's very informative. I felt that's the way I felt, you know, getting great information value. But another thing is it's not necessarily the case that it's harder to interact with groups than with people, you know, to one-on-one. So, and I do believe, I mean, I do have lots of concerns, and that's why I also find it very important to be immersed with the teachers and the parents. And, you know, when something works, it just feels right. And when it doesn't feel right, for example, it didn't feel right for Ruby to move. We thought it was going to be a great idea to move autonomously. It's a big robot. It scared the children. It doesn't feel right. You don't want to have scared children. The new Ruby is actually smaller. And I think that had a tremendous influence on the children interacting more and more with her. They were less scared. So yes, I do. I do share concerns a lot, but that's why I think it's very important to be immersed with the parents and the teachers.
Okay. Well, it's 4:30. I want to thank Javier because he's right. We did having Ruby on our team did. Go a long way towards helping us get the Science of Learning Center. So thank you, Javier.